John Constantine, a Hellblazer podcast.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Hell Talk. Today, we are going through issues number 59 through 67. This is like a really good chunk. Of course, as always, I got my co-host, Hoku.
Hello.
And this is where Hellblazer starts to pick up for me. I don't know about you. What'd you think of this whole little section?
Oh, this was so much fun. I loved where it went and all the little bits and all the little stories. It was fun because it wasn't one big chunk. It was actually like individual stories mixed with like little three issue arcs, I think each one was.
Yeah. Not super long. I like that they just kind of get in and get out with like stories that matter. And I will say, like, it seems like this is where, like I said, Garth Ennis's run starts to pick up its momentum. Like, it's getting into the, I guess it would be, like, the second part of it. Because the first part of his run is kind of, like, building up these new characters, like Kit, and even building Chaz, who was an older character. But we hadn't really gotten much character building with their relationship, or at least the relationship between John and him. So, I feel like he's doing that on purpose because he needs you to know those characters are there and they mean a lot to John and they're supposed to mean a lot to you. Because the further we get into this, you kind of see, oh shit, there's some stuff going on. Something's going to happen. So, the first arc in this is called Guys and Dolls. And I think this still counts as like a character building part. Like, this is his last character building section, and then we get into the real like meat of his story where he's been trying to go. So this first one builds up the succubus Ellie. What'd you think of this one specifically?
I loved this story. I've always been a sucker for like angel demon romance stories. Not that I have not read a lot of them, but I always love the idea of them, you know, the forbidden love
right
trope of that, what it's like an ultimate angel and demon together totally represents, right? Like it's the big one. It's like the highest you can go with the forbidden love. And so I had a great time with this one. I thought it was so beautiful and also so heart-wrenching. Mm-hmm. You know, especially at the end, which was just like they trusted John to help them, and he made the wrong like call about who he thought was after them, and then that just put them completely in danger, and it was heartbreaking. Oh, I was so sad.
Yeah. Well, and an interesting thing, I don't think this is the first time I've ever shown like the intervention of heaven in such a, you know, like outwardly thing, right? Like before you just know there's like a God, I guess, and they talk about him kind of like he's up there. But it's different in this because they actually show the angels coming down and they're doing stuff. And most of the time the angels aren't really doing much.
Yeah. They're like in the background, just kind of milling around. They get referred to, like obviously, Constantine knows they're there, and he's always just like, oh, yeah, those guys. But it's usually the demons who are the ones, like, making shit happen, like, messing shit up, like, attacking people that, like, John knows, or, you know, just shenanigans in general seem to be more of the demons thing. But, yeah, so that was a really cool twist to have it be that, you know, it's like the demon that he went to talk to was like, what are you talking about? And he's just like, oh, shit. It's not you guys. Oh shit. And then has to like run back and it's too late.
Yeah. The heavenly host sigils, you know,
has come by and has just been like, like, kill this guy and take the baby bomb.
Yeah. And it's funny, like, the this reminded me a lot of, like Supernatural, the show. I don't know if you've watched that show, but they kind of have a similar thing where, like, the first couple episodes, it's just demons. And then eventually they're like, wait, wait, we could have angels too. And then, like, so they start adding, like, angels and that kind of lore in it as well. Even though, like, God has been, you know, talked about in the show, but they've only fought demons. And then once they get to a certain level, they're like, oh no, now there's angels too and God and all this stuff. And it adds, like, a whole nother dimension. I feel like that kind of is what happened here, where I'm like, oh shit, like, now there's, like, a God or heaven is actually playing an active role in whatever John's doing. And it's not just, like, it's not just the demons and then, like, fate falls towards heaven or something, you know, like, kind of, that's kind of how it was before, like, oh, just good would triumph or things like that, but, or at least demons would lose. But now it's like,
I mean, I guess it kind of happened, you know, I mean, the demon lost and heaven won.
Right. But they actively came down and did something, right? That's, yeah.
Yeah. Apparently John's leveling up.
Yeah. And, yes, he's gotten his ability
to attract certain kinds of people and, beyond the demonic entities, he's now attracting the angelic entities as well with either his actions or through the people he is now surrounding himself with.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, this arc is a very interesting arc as well. If you've read other kind of Vertigo titles from Garth Ennis, have you ever read Preacher?
I have not.
Okay. So I was reading Preacher, like, right after I first read this, like, in the mid-2000s, so I read this Guys and Dolls storyline or whatever, and then everybody's like, oh, you got to read Preacher if you like Garth Ennis. I'm like, okay. And Preacher starts off with, like, once upon a time, there was an angel and a demon, and they had sex, and they had a baby, and this is their baby. And I was like, wait a second. I've read this premise before.
Are you telling me that they took the kid from this arc and threw it into a whole nother side story?
Not exactly. It's not supposed to be the same kid, but it's like, that's the premise of Preacher that I guess Garth liked from this run. He was like, I like the idea of that. I'm going to throw it in another comic I make right after I do this run. So, so pretty much when he finishes. Cool. Yeah. And then Steve Dillon is the artist in that. So.
I thought you were going to say, like, and this is actually a spinoff, like how Hellblazer is a spinoff, and now this is a spinoff of Hellblazer. And I was like, oh, kind of like when a show, like, popular characters come, like, have their own show, and then a character in that show gets their own show, and it's just like a whole
line. Well, I'm going to say this. Too. I don't think so, because I've never read Preacher all the way through, so maybe it is and I'm off, but I'm pretty sure it's just like the idea of that, like an angel and demon get together and have a baby is what Preacher's based on, not the actual baby that, because in this, the angels take the baby. So
yeah, what did they do with the baby?
You don't want to know what they did. I don't know.
Oh.
Yeah, that's one
maybe
thing
they
that's
did like, on. Maybe they did like, you know, with like the X-Men thing where they just put it in a room and then they're just like, let's see what happens if this child will be good or bad or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's almost like Tefe or something. Like, she's like part demon and part god elemental or something in Swamp Thing.
And part human and part...
Yeah, all that.
She's a whole mutt.
Yeah. So, like, I don't know. This one of the things that they never come back to, I don't think, in this run is, like, what happened to the baby that Ellie and the angel had. But I think
that is such a loose end. Oh, my gosh.
It is, but I never noticed it until I read it this time. And then I was like, wait, what does happen to that baby? Because he went to go do Preacher, and I guess that's what happens to that baby in his mind, in like Garth's mind. He's like, oh, I'm gonna spin off here, but like an unofficial spinoff. But then yeah, there's an actual baby somewhere in Constantine's old world where in his history where it could show up at any point. So I don't know. Maybe it does later on in like future runs. I'm not sure. I haven't read.
Yeah, because that's some untapped potential there.
Yeah, for sure. So we get that. What do you think of like the whole like how he hides Ellie, like he carves a sigil under her soul? It's so fucked up.
Actually, I'm glad. Well, I don't know if the actual panels showed the actual carving or not, but I do like the idea that they... Okay, cool. Because I love the idea that they just described it, or, you know, he just basically says that. And then it's up to your mind to figure out how does one carve something onto a soul.
Yeah, probably.
Like, it's as brutal and horrible and painful as you could possibly imagine. Right. So we don't have to even draw you that picture, because if you've got a decent enough imagination, you can probably see for yourself just how horrible that would be.
Yeah. And like,
that was awesome.
The closest they get to that is they show Ellie's face screaming and then the symbol kind of like hovering over it, but they don't show what's happening or how it actually got carved in. So
and then at the end she's just like covered in blood or something, right?
Yeah, she's just like, she has a scar.
Because there's a bloody mattress or whatever.
Yeah. So it's good. What do you think of the character of Ellie in general? Like, do you like her as a...
I like that she's been unexpectedly like both an antagonist and also like the protagonist. She's kind of gone... I mean, we didn't know about this when we first met her, and you kind of just assume that she's just like, oh, she's just another demon that John happens to know. But then you get this really rich, tragic backstory to her, and you're like, oh, I actually feel sorry for her, even though she's a demon and she's obviously done and will do horrible things. You still kind of feel for her, which is the best kind of character to have.
Yeah.
Like, as like a villain who isn't really, well, I mean, yes, okay, yeah, she's a villain, totally a villain, but at the same time she has this really tragic story to her that makes it kind of like, oh, I feel bad for her. I mean, you're still a demon, but that really sucked, that was horrible what happened to you.
Yeah, it's I like her character a lot. I also like that she's always like flirting with John, only because she's like a succubus, or at least that's what it seems like. Like, whenever she's talking to him, she's in, like, suggestive poses and stuff. And I like how...
And suggesting things.
Yeah.
Just like, so what do you want me to do, like, to pay you back?
Yeah. And he's like, nah, it's fine. Don't worry about it. Like, I like that John has no interest whatsoever, which is fun as well.
I kind of wonder if that means he just, like, is it because he knows what she is that there isn't that automatic attraction she seems to have with normal people?
Yeah, maybe because he knows he can, like, magically block it or something. He can't be tempted. Yeah, I don't know. They don't explain that at all. He just isn't.
Kind of like
other people
turn off a switch or something. Or, like, oh, what was it? Like, the movie Michael, when the one lady's like, well, why am I not attracted? He's like, because I don't want you to be. It would mess everything up. She's just like, oh, really? But every other woman around him is just like, oh.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Maybe something like that. Turn it off.
Yeah.
But on John's side.
Yeah, maybe, but then she is still like sitting in suggestive poses and stuff around him naked, because she's only wearing like a towel in the hotel room. So yeah, and also I thought it'd be fun, like, because he says like, I couldn't take her home to like Kit's house. And it's like, yeah, that would be a problem if there's like this, we'll say an attractive woman, right? And she's like throwing up. So, like, she's doing like Basic Instinct leg spreading and closing or whatever, like while talking to you and stuff. And when you have a girlfriend, it's like, yeah, it's not gonna work out.
Plus, you don't know, Kit might have been into her too.
Right.
I don't want that either.
Yeah, that might be it too. You're right. So, yeah, I just like that whole like setup a lot in this one, and I do appreciate that this pays off. This, like, introduction of Ellie and what happened between her and John pays off immediately. Because the last time we saw Ellie was when he had cancer, like, the first arc of this. So, like, the Dangerous Habits arc of the Garth Ennis run. So, it's been a while. It's been, like, over a year in real time, you know, as these issues have come out since we saw her.
I didn't even realize that.
Yeah, because she only shows up to be like, oh, maybe you should talk to the snob, and that's it. And then...
Yeah.
I
totally forgot that's how long it's been.
Yeah. And then this is the first time she comes back, but he spent a lot of time, one, building up John and what he's able to do now that he's got, not cancer and all that stuff. And then, and like, I before it always felt like in the Jamie Delano run, it's like he was more like reactive magically. Like he can do stuff, but it's not like he's not necessarily great at it. But I think because Delano opened up like, oh, with him being like the Magus now and he's got like his twin absorbed, he could like, you could change it so he's more competent magically. Cause in this, he does like do more things magic wise that are like active. Like he's carving sigils. He's into like her soul. He's never done anything quite like that before, you know, in like the Jamie Delano run. So, I feel like this is where like it starts kicking off and we get to see John really this like in at the beginning of run. It's at the beginning of the run. It's just about him like curing cancer. And then once he does that, he's doing a lot more things like magic-y things, you know?
Just not for himself either. He's also like, people are coming to him for help and he's actually like, okay, I can do this. Like, I can actually take care of this. Whereas before, he might have just been, like, pissed off. Yeah. Or, like, I don't want to get involved. But probably with that sort of change in his way of thinking, he's feeling more powerful, more complete. So maybe that also has contributed to him being like, I'll help them out. Not only because he assumes, you know, oh, if I help them, I have them, you know, in my pocket and they'll owe me. But also because he knows he could do it, or at least believes he can do it. So that's probably a change in his mindset as well.
Right. Yeah. I think that's right. So after this Guys and Dolls storyline, we learn about like him and Ellie's relationship. We get a couple of, I guess, like one shot issues that give us a little breather, but still kind of reintroduce us to some characters like issue 62, which is called End of the Line. That's like where we catch up with John's family and like, so we get to meet, or we get reintroduced into John's sister and her family, which we haven't seen for a very long time. I feel like the last time we maybe saw Cheryl was when he was like, oh, I'm dying. So like he gave her a letter or whatever. But before that, even it was just like issue 3 of Hellblazer where like her,
wasn't it also when his dad died?
Oh yeah. When his dad died too. So like they show it every now and then. This is the first
time. Yeah, like the ghost, the grandpa's ghost or whatever was haunting.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, because they mentioned that in the story, because he's talking about Gemma specifically because she's been dabbling in magic
stuff. Gemma, yes. And, I forgot her name.
Yeah, Gemma, yeah. And Gemma's been dabbling in magic to, like, get back at this high school girl or whatever. And, of course, Cheryl thinks John is helping her with that because who else? It's like, it's funny because it'd be like in your family if the uncle smokes weed and then you find weed in your kid's bedroom. You're like, who gave you this? It was John, wasn't it? And it's like, but it's magic. It's like, it's funny.
And he's just like, no, I only smoke weed for myself. I'd never push it on anyone else.
Yeah, why would I?
Why would you think it was me? I'm always saying like, you know, if you shouldn't do this because reasons.
You know my motto, don't do drugs.
Yeah.
But also, I make it look super cool and effective.
So do this, even though it makes you look cool. And,
yeah.
And, you know, feel good. And,
yeah. Yeah.
You know, people look up to you and ask you for stuff.
Yeah. And take control of your life. And, you know, all this stuff. It's one of those things. Of course, Gemma and other people. But it's kind of funny to see how, like, other people in Gemma's life, like the kid that actually did show her how to do the magic or whatever. Like, he's just a Constantine fanboy, which I thought was fun. He's like, I was going to be like you. Like, and there was that moment where John's like, where did you learn this? And he's like, from you.
Yeah. Or first of all, like the fact that he recognized him and Constantine's like, oh shit, how the hell does he know who I am? He's like, oh yeah, this one guy. And, you know, was like a friend of his or something, or just somebody who knew Constantine or about Constantine. That was it, right? It was like a friend of Constantine's, or just an acquaintance or somebody.
I can't remember how he knew, but he knew. I can't remember.
Yeah, it was some guy that he's like, oh yeah, so and so told me all about you, and he's like, son of a bitch, how dare he?
Oh,
like,
that's right. Yeah, that's what it was.
I forget who he was specifically, but yeah, he's just like, that bastard, I'm gonna get him after I get this kid. And I love that he curses him.
like a fake
but doesn't actually do anything because he knows that kid and knows just enough to be like, oh, what has he done to me? Oh, I'm horrible. Or like, how can I live now? Like, he's a real deal. He wouldn't just like not curse me when he says these things. So
yeah.
I thought that was the best way to get back at that guy without actually doing anything.
Yeah. You know, it was hard reading that curse that he said.
Oh, yeah.
For the podcast. I was like, God damn it. I got to pronounce all these Latin words in a row and make them sound like he's actually doing a spell. That's hard.
Well, you did a good job. It sounded very, very John convincing.
Thank you. So we get that little just like kind of one-off issue about, you know, him kind of reintroducing us to Cheryl and stuff. Which is also interesting for the end of this. We'll talk about it when we get there, but just the idea that, like, okay, so obviously he's introducing Ellie and what's going on here for the upcoming story arc that's after these three issues. And then but he also, like, through all of this, he's setting up him and Kit and, like, how they're doing and their relationship, and it's going really good. And also, like, him and Chaz, we already had, like, in our last episode, we covered the ones with the bodies and stuff. That's all Kit's uncle and all that, or Chaz's uncle. So like, that's their character building, you know, like, so we get, oh, they're great. They're best mates. They're great friends and all that.
Buddies, they're pals, they're amigos.
Yeah. Exactly.
Wrestle around.
Wrestle. but yeah, so it's kind of like, if you don't know Garth Ennis, it's like, you're like, oh yeah, this is great. We're really getting a lot of stuff in John's life fleshed out. But if you know Garth Ennis, you're like, wait a second. Why the hell is he making John so happy right now? Like, you're getting all suspicious about John's life. And in the next issue, it basically says, like, this is like the warning issue, and it's the Hellblazer special, which is, like, I guess also a good jumping on point for new readers that wanted to get into Hellblazer, because this is the first issue that was branded with Vertigo imprint, I guess.
Ooh, that's cool.
Yeah, which was a big deal, I guess, you know, that happened in Swamp Thing and all those titles that were, like, mature. They were like, we're starting a new thing called Vertigo. And this was the first issue where you could jump on, you know, you could catch up with John in his past a little bit. And then catch up to, okay, there's this guy that's after me called the First, and he's been after me for a long time. So I like this issue as far as that. But this was also like, oh, this guy's, like, not going to stop. The First is going to come back. He's been in John's life forever, and now he's still fucking with him and all this stuff. So, what did you think of this, like, issue in general?
I thought that it should have been part of the run and not a special issue, because it's a very important story. Like,
yeah, it's a lot of John,
it matters.
John history in there.
How did they cut it out? Like, or how did they keep it separate that way? I mean, it's almost like a special would be something that doesn't tie into the main storyline. So I feel like this is such an important story.
I think it depends when you got into reading comics. Because, like, I think after, like, 2000, what you're thinking is how it is now. Like, a special is usually not needed, and I guess technically this isn't needed as part of this story arc, but it is needed in my mind, at least, to John's you know, character or whatever, right?
I mean, it feels like, you know, the other issue 40 should have been the special, because that kind of is a bringing everyone together happy time special. So that would be a way to show off, hey, here's a wide range of characters that we have. Like, come join us and, like, check out these characters and other things, versus this issue, which was, like, very specific to this point in the story and has to do with, like, the journey he's on right now, you know, with the First and just his own growth and stuff. So it just seems so weird that you would have an issue that's essentially a party as, like, part of the run versus an issue that's really important to John's growth and his battle with the first and his own psyche and his history and his past is like a separate special. It just seems flipped to me, honestly.
I gotcha. I think, like I said, after 2000, that's what it would have been, or, you know, it would have been the other way around. Because nowadays, if they put out a special, it's not necessarily like you have to read it or anything. But back in the 90s, I feel like they would just do this shit all the time. Like, if, when I'm collecting, I'm always like, oh, fuck, there was like a weird thing that I needed to know about, but it was released as a one shot that hopefully you picked up, you know? And if you didn't, you'd be like, wait, where am I at? What's going on?
So, yeah, it just like seems kind of weird.
Yeah.
To put, like, you know, critical information, or maybe not critical, but adjacent information that would enhance important. The story in a place that maybe some people might not catch and therefore be deprived of that particular bit of information when it would be important to the story, you know, like it means something. It's not just a party.
Yeah. Well, in this one, like, you know, it's where he decides, like, or he says, like, this guy's coming after me and something bad's going to happen now. Like, he means business because he's released this priest to fuck with my head. And that's another level, right? It's not just physical harm that he's trying to do. He's trying to, like, mentally fuck with him. So, yeah, I think it's an important issue. And I think this is just what they did in comics back in the day, was they made, like, one-offs and stuff important to maybe not the story, but, like, the character, right? It would be like something that if you missed it, you wouldn't notice it. But if you did, if you caught it, you're like, oh, wow, that's so much more, you know, that's so much more. I just wish I knew that beforehand, because I don't think I'd ever read this before this run. I'm trying to remember.
Oh, wow.
I don't remember if this was included in the trades before, like before the ones they do now. Because when I read this, it was in like the mid 2000s. So, I don't know if the trade paperback of this was in that. If this was in that.
Well, it was a really cool story. I mean, I thought it gave us a great slice of John's history and a little bit more of that, because they always give you just a little tidbit of like, and then this bad thing happened and that's why he got into magic. And then this is almost like a clarifying, well, actually, it wasn't necessarily because like that thing happened. It was this moment with the priest that sort of drove him in the direction where at first he was like, oh, maybe I'll get into magic. I'm just going to go to London and dick around. And now it's like, no, I don't ever want to feel like this again. I'm going to get my hands on some magic. And yeah. So that was like, you know, a really shocking revelation to find out that this was sort of like a real linchpin in his history with just kind of how he turned out.
Yes. I mean, it is important to his character, but it's not important to the story necessarily. I think that's like the differentiation they made, and that's why they put it out as a special. But I mean, in context of reading it with this whole little section, I'm like, yeah, it's totally needed. It just makes more, I think it was, like I said, it's supposed to be a jumping on point. So they didn't want it to be just a random 72 or whatever, or 43 or 63 is what it would be. They didn't want it to be just a random number. They wanted it to be like, hey, everybody noticed it's a number one on here. It's a special. Jump on and pick it up. Like, I think that was also it as well. So I'm trying to think. I don't think Swamp Thing did a one shot, but I don't remember. Maybe they did. I can't remember if they just had it be the first issue or if it was like, no, it's a special issue. Or if it was just part of the, you know, the next issue in the run was the first Vertigo title. I can't remember, but
it was a great jumping on point, I will say, because if you knew absolutely nothing about John or his journey or anything, you would certainly be like, what the hell is going on? Who is this first? Like, what? Who is this character? Like, what is going on here? And then you'd probably want to, like, figure out more about this, you know, this random guy in his life and how he's like mixed up in magic and craziness and the fact that it is both, you know, descriptive about what this guy's done to people, which I'm sure would intrigue people who are only used to reading about superheroes and stuff and like lighter fair. So the fact that it goes into these dark places is also really intriguing to people who might not have known about it. If they were just like, oh, Hellblazer issue 45, that's too many, I don't want to get in there.
Yeah. I think, yeah. I think also, yeah, like, okay, so I don't know if you know this, but when you have a number one on a book, like sales spike usually because people are like, oh, it's a number one, I can jump on. They just see the number one. So I think that's why they wanted to do it, because they're like, if we put a number one on the book, people will jump on and then they can continue at issue four or issue 63. And then 63 is the birthday issue where he turns 40. And that, I think, is very specific as well. Like, it's very calculated, because this is the issue where if you jumped on with the last issue, you get to meet the entire cast that's going to be for the rest of Garth Ennis's run in this one issue.
Well, that's tricky.
Yeah.
And I suppose well thought out. All right, I see what you're doing here.
Yeah, I think they did that on purpose. You even see Swamp Thing and everything, so you get their relationship. Doesn't make any sense if you read reading Swamp Thing.
Where was he again when this was going on? Where's Swamp Thing supposed to be?
This is right
time towards, or something.
I believe this is in the end of the Nancy Collins run when Swamp Thing left Abby with his doppelganger and he was fighting, he was like melting from the toxic waste. And in the middle of that issue or that storyline, he supposedly went to here. And was like, happy birthday, John.
he couldn't go back into the green specifically because he was so toxic. He had to wait for the toxins to be cleansed. So he is literally just a walking pile of radiative goo. And somehow he managed to zip over to John's party, poof a pot plant into like mega tree plant of pot. And then say like, "Bye, I gotta get back to my family," and then go.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Back to if his it was, ooey gooey body.
I don't remember if it was before or after he had the toxicness of him, because that really wouldn't make sense. I think it wasn't quite as he was. I think it was just he had left and he was about to fight the toxic monster or something, and then right before he fights him, it's like, "Hey, buddy, like I'll make some weed for you."
Oh yeah, because it couldn't have been after, because that's when he gets his 90s like reboot, yes, right? So, yeah. So it couldn't have been. So it had to have been before he got toxic. But then, you know, he's like about to prepare to fight. He's like, oh, wait, I got this letter at my house. I got to go say hi to figure out what this letter is, because it could be more important than fighting a toxic monster.
Yes. Yeah, so it didn't quite make sense, but they just wanted to throw in like that he knows. Also, you know what doesn't make sense is Swamp Thing could grow a weed plant from nothing. He doesn't need Nigel to go to his house to get his weed plant or whatever.
I mean, he could have literally just picked a leaf off his body and turned it into a weed plant, or like a crumb on the ground weed plant,
or just made a weed plant grow. He didn't need any of that. By this point in Swamp Thing, he is all powerful almost with plant stuff, at least. So yeah, like they've established he could grow anything anywhere anytime. And then this is funny because they're like, Nigel, go run to your place and get your weed plant. And also, I loved that everybody was like, oh my God, you have a weed plant? That's crazy. Like, it was just so quaint, the 90s.
I almost thought that maybe they were being sarcastic when Zatanna was like, oh, look at that amazing thing, and it's this tiny little baby. Maybe they were being like sarcastic or just like humoring.
That could be. Possibly. Maybe I just missed the humor in it.
To me, it, like a compliment like that, when you say it's just like this tiny little baby thing, it's almost like, oh yeah, that's amazing. Look at what you've done, man. Like, good job.
So you know, like a lot of that sarcasm, that sarcasm is hard to pick up in the, if you're just reading it. And especially if I didn't catch it, then I'm reading it to y'all and then it's like, fuck, I missed that. So maybe, yeah, you're right. Maybe they were making fun of him.
I mean, it was just my thought, because the way she said it, or at least the words she said, and then the picture you painted of the plant, to me, I'd have been like, oh, she's making fun of him, but like in a nice way.
Yeah. I think because it was Zatanna, right? Like if other characters had said it, and they usually give them like a smile on their face, like a shifty kind of like.
So maybe she was genuinely being like, oh, like, good job. You're
Yeah, I thought that's what it
you're
was.
You're doing good.
But maybe he was like he just meant because it's Zatanna and we don't know her that well. Maybe he was like, yeah, she's going to make fun of him, but I didn't get it. Well, now I got to go back and read it and see. Yeah, but so
this definitive version.
Exactly. And so this issue also introduces a couple more characters that we'd never seen before. His biker friend, or his biker looking friend, Heather, and then Rick the Vic, the priest guy that he knows. What'd you think? Like, so this is just kind of a random, like, hey, people we've never heard of are showing up. Like, what'd you think of that?
I almost feel like Rick the Vic was mentioned at some point because his name sounded really familiar when you said it. Is it possible he may have been like mentioned in passing?
He might have mentioned him, but we definitely haven't seen him before.
Okay. Because his name, like the way, you know, the way it just rolls off the tongue, Rick the Vic, just sounds like something someone would have said before in one of the other issues at some point. So, you know, a friend in passing, oh, hey, what's Rick the Vic up to or whatever, just something like that. So that, I think that was the only name to me that felt like he seems familiar, but I don't know if I've actually, you know, experienced his character before. It was just a name that was thrown out at some point.
Yeah.
That like thankfully was then developed into a character. So that's cool if that's the way it happened.
Yeah. And they go about it right away. Cause once they introduce not Heather, but once they introduce Rick in this issue, in the next issue, he's used right away. So you kind of like, okay, this is what he does. And this is how John knows a priest and how they're friends and stuff. So, in this next story arc, Fear and Loathing, this arc is the one where I think this is the one that really like, kicks off like officially the second half of Garth Ennis's run. And like, it doesn't stop from here. Like to me, this is where he's like, all right, I've set everything up and go. Like, because not only does it like push the story forward to where we end, but it, or to where we end today. It also like amps up the violence and the topics that they're talking about. And like, for instance, there's a lot of stuff about racism in this issue or in this story arc. And so far, at least in Ennis's run, they mention racists. They like in the Delano run, they showed like the British boys, you know, that kind of yell slurs at people. I'd say the most we get, it's not racism, but the most we got like violence wise was the killing of his friend Ray Mondi, the gay friend that he had at the beginning of Delano's run. That was like super violence towards gay people. I don't think we've seen straight up like neo-Nazi-ish, very like attacks on black people yet. I don't think. Have we? I can't remember.
I don't think so. I think you're right as far as like the lines they've tread before with, like, yes, like there are horrible things and horrible people out there, but this one definitely felt heavier than some of the other times when they've dabbled in confronting these sorts of topics. So yeah, this one was rough.
Yeah. And it's this one, because they set up in the first issue, like, oh, you know, here's his friends, Dez and his brother, George. And they're just kind of like, oh, hey, what's up, Constantine? And then you don't think anything of it. And then by the second issue, like, Dez is pretty much dead at the end, or like, you know, dying. And it's like, oh my God, like, what the fuck? This is super fucked up. So, like,
and it was literally just for like association of like being next to him and being like, hey, what are you doing to, you know, that guy that my brother knows or whatever, you know, right. Like, cause wasn't it his brother was Constantine's friend?
Yeah, Dez is Constantine's friend. George was just there for the ride and never met him.
Right. So it's just one of those horrible, like, wrong time, wrong place moments of, you know, hey, what are you doing to my brother's friend? And then, you know, slashed a thousand times or whatever by that guy. And it was just, ugh, so horrible.
And I love that there's like two storylines going on at the same time. So there's that one where like John is getting kidnapped by these Nazi guys and they're attacking Dez and him, and And because Dez is black, they're like, oh, we can cut him up and torture him, basically. And then that'll make John talk. And then they also send, you know, goons to Kit's house to teach John a or give John a message that way. And then in the background on the other story that's going on is the angel Gabriel, who we've known as the snob before this, is fallen in love or
a sweet love story. Yeah. Oh, so unassuming and innocent. Yeah. And precious. All this other horrible shit is going on.
Love that storyline. That storyline is fantastic, especially since we haven't seen Gabriel since he told John he's not going to help him with his lung cancer. And then we cut back to here, and they even bring back, like, the guy who's racist is the guy who John saw at the club in that issue where he's asked Gabriel to help him. And ever since then, you know, John said, like, hey, you know that guy's, like, super racist and God would not want you to talk to him. And ever since then, the snob or Gabriel has been, like, having a crisis of faith. And it's been, like, over a year, right? So, like, just imagine Gabriel, like, every day goes to sit by this fireplace at the Cambridge Club and is like, who am I? Like,
he's literally stewing from, like, a throwaway sentence by John that has completely destroyed his whole, like, being and, like, sense of, like, knowing where who he is and where he stands. I can't even imagine, like, something that could destroy someone so thoroughly as just a random, almost throwaway comment was
right.
Just crazy to think that he hasn't gotten over that yet. He's still there, like, just unable to get past, like, so what does it mean? Like, why did my father never intervene when I was talking to these people? Like, does that mean he doesn't care? Like, does it mean he does care and he's testing me? Just like, like, just constant turmoil for a year is, like, crazy.
Yeah, and also that little offhanded comment causes the death of Dez. You know what I mean? Like it had consequences not just for Gabriel, but because Gabriel is going through this crisis of faith or whatever, he leaves the Cambridge Club, which alerts whatever the guy's name, Charlie Patterson or whatever, and then. And because of that, that's why he's like, oh, we need to get John, and Dez is hanging out with John when that happens. So it's like a long string of events that it seems like, and it's really set up well. It makes it feel like it means something, like he's been planning this forever. It's really well done writing, I think, in comics for that part.
It was sort of a crazy snowball effect that you just assume. Oh, you know, okay, so he's just stewing about this, and it's, you know, like, it's going to go somewhere, obviously. We don't expect it to pick up so much momentum so quickly that it happens in these three issues, that everything that has happened in the past year, and obviously Gabriel's just been in the background, you know, thinking, but him finally getting up to leave and move and, like, walk and think for the first time ever, I guess, because they seem surprised that he's even, like, leaving.
Well, they say that the club. He just vanishes normally, but this time he, like, walked out and they're like, what the fuck, he walks out?
Yeah.
Where's he going?
So just, I think, you know, that, and then of course him meeting what was her name again?
Julie,
right? Yes. And then him meeting Julie, and then that snowballing into a relationship. Meanwhile, you know, you've got John and Kit. Oh my gosh.
Oh,
Kit.
Yeah. I was going to ask.
I love Kit so much.
I was going to ask. Yeah. This is where Kit, I mean, we've always kind of seen her, like, hold her own when she's talking to John and stuff, but she holds her own in a different way in this. So I was going to ask you, what do you think of Kit in this storyline?
I thought she's amazing. She's Wonder Woman. I aspire to be her someday. Not necessarily that I want to follow in her footsteps, but if push ever came to shove, I'd hope I'd be able to, like, have half the you know, the courage and the balls that she has, because she really knows how to take care of herself. And I mean, I don't think I've seen anyone John been with anyone who's as self-sufficient since Zed, maybe.
Yeah, but even Zed was putting on, like, a front, right? And then she went through her whole crusade Resurrection Crusade thing. And then she was kind of like a powerful pagan magic person. But, and then he went with Marge after that. And she was kind of like not that. She was like the opposite.
Yeah, she's like the opposite of that. Yeah. Total pushover. But yeah, Kit, damn it, man. Kit is the shit.
Yeah.
You really screwed this up, John. You really screwed this up and yeah. didn't own it either.
Great so, girl, yeah, and you fucked it up.
God damn it, John.
But man, you never know where they're going to go with how they handle violence towards women in comics and stuff. Like, and Kit obviously is a strong character, but I love that they're like, okay, she's standing next to a sink. She puts her hands in the water. There's a knife in there. She stabs the guy in the dick. like, or I don't know if it's the dick, but it's close enough. It's the pelvic region.
It's in the crotch area. Yeah. Definitely she damaged something. And I don't know if that, unless he made it to a hospital,
I don't think he was able
to recover from that.
No, I don't think he made it. It's not. No good. But at the same time that's happening, Dez is getting cut up by a knife as well. There's like the whole where he's cutting his face up with a razor. Like it's interesting how they
made that was awful
in the issue. I mean, it makes sense. Like it makes sense
symbolically. Yeah.
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 I get you.
But yeah, that issue is a hard issue to read. Because of the ending with Dez and him getting cut up with a razor blade and stuff. So, and then also like we just got introduced to these guys, like to Dez and his brother. So, I don't know. Obviously you need people to be put into situations so that John can react. That would be the only like criticism I could think of is you just introduced this black guy to get murdered. So that John could, you know, get really mad or whatever. And then, I think the only thing that undercuts that reading of it, which is kind of like a modern reading. Some people would, like, I think back in the '90s, you just read this and go like, wow, that's fucked up. Damn. But now you kind of, everybody analyzes things on different levels. So, I could see people reading that and be like, I don't like that. But then in the next issue, the last issue of Fear and Loathing, we get like the George part of the story where George is his brother who doesn't know Constantine really. And he's looking for his brother and he doesn't know that his brother's dead until he finds finally where John's supposed to be. And then he sees these guys loading up his brother's body in the trunk of a car. And he's like, oh my God. And so he just totally turns everything on its head. And I kind of like that. This arc specifically ended a lot different than I thought with that side of the story. Because John is, after he gets mad, he's setting Charlie Patterson up, and he's like, he's doing his normal like machinations in his head while he's acting like a badass, saying different things to Charlie in the room, and then that's all ended because fucking as Charlie's about to leave, and like makes a deal with John, his fucking head gets blown off. By George, who's just like, yeah, fuck whatever deal you guys had. I'm here because you guys are racist assholes and you killed my brother. So I think that's kind of like the redeeming factor of that issue, even though it ends differently than I thought and probably what you thought. I thought it was going to be like a normal Constantine, like, oh, you made a deal. What's the deal? What's going to happen? It was like, no, there's no deal. His head just gets blown off and George tells John, fuck off, basically. What'd you think of that?
Well, I will say that it didn't seem like John was as sad about, him dying. Like, sure, he had to literally sit there and listen to him die, and I'm sure that that was traumatizing for him. And then he had to put on a brave front of, like, I don't give a fuck to the other guys. But it seemed like when he was talking to his brother and when, it seems like his most important thing is like, no, wait, I have a deal to, like, with this dude. Don't kill him. Instead of like, hey, this asshole just killed your brother. I can get back at him, right. In a much more horrible way. And I can get more than just him. I can do so much more. It just seemed like he wasn't convincing enough to me to make his brother stop. And maybe nothing he said would have convinced him.
Well, his head was like yeah, he'd already just blown off Charlie's head at that point.
No, I thought he like shot him in the chest and then he was still technically alive-ish. You're right.
Yeah, yeah. I guess technically he could have got to the hospital maybe.
You know, could have gotten to the hospital, probably would have been, you know, paralyzed or, you know, something, you know, I'm breathing mask for the rest of his life or whatever. But he could have maybe, because if he had saved his life at that point, he could have even made a better deal or something. But yeah, the fact that to me, John didn't seem either that apologetic or that sorry or remorseful about how the situation played out, and his whole focus was like, no, wait, I made a deal. That, yeah, it totally, to me, it seemed like his brother was going to be like, well, fuck you, fuck your deal, fuck this guy, and just, you know, kill him.
Right.
So, and maybe that's just John thinking about himself and not so much about the lives that were lost this time.
I honestly think that's kind of classic John as well, because that's generally how John's life has gone. If you're a friend of John's, when push comes to shove, he will kind of do things that get him where he wants to be, regardless of how you end up, you know?
That's true.
Now, he didn't plan for Dez to get hurt, but Dez is already dead. So John's like, nah, this, I'm going to get my revenge on this asshole, and this is how it's going to go. And then when it doesn't go that way, Dez is already dead. So he doesn't know. I mean, he doesn't know George other than, you know, you're Dez's brother. So.
Oh, I got that mixed up. I thought Dez was the brother he didn't know and George was the one who did.
No. It's the other way.
Oh, okay. It was the other way around. So, yeah, again, if he knew Dez and Dez was actually kind of like a friend, he has been more remorseful when his friends have died, especially if it's been in direct, you know, for being in direct contact with him. So it just seems, it seems to me he was maybe this time just not quite as sympathetic as he should have been to a brother who just lost his brother. And, you know, if you really were going to convince him to let that guy live or at least not, you know, shoot him again, he should have at least tried, to me, a little harder to be like, hey, man, I know your brother just died. I'm so sorry about that. You know, but I know I swear I can get them all. I can get every single one of them and then, you know, try a little harder instead of just being like, hey, wait, no, don't. Like, I have a plan.
Yeah.
And then just, yeah.
You know, it could also be, I mean, obviously John has a second plan going on in the background with Gabriel. So maybe because he's like, he's got like this big overarching plan with this angel. And then also he's got to worry about the first of the fallen. So maybe it's just like he's his bandwidth is taken up and he doesn't have time to really feel remorse or whatever, or sadness for this at the moment of it happening. You know, he hasn't had time to think about it, or he doesn't know what's going on with Gabriel yet.
Whether it's actually happening, yeah, besides the fact that he got the little check-in of like, it seems to be going in the right way, but you still don't know how long it's going to take, or, you know, if it's actually going to come to fruition as much as he hopes it will.
Yeah.
So, okay.
So
yeah.
That could be, he's in the background of his
little
mind,
distracted, yeah. Little distracted by everything else that's going on. And this was sort of like a plan that seemed more spur of the moment. I honestly even wonder if he was going to go through with it in the first place. You know, if he was just saying that, oh yeah, you can have him when I'm done, or was he going to end up killing them anyway? So for the most part, it would have just been he could get more of them, but that guy dying really didn't mess anything up for him, really.
Right. This whole Charlie Patterson thing was just a kind of wrench in the gears in the first place, because it all wasn't supposed to happen. He has other shit going on that he's dealing with. So it could be that too. It could be a mix of that altogether. But speaking of Gabriel, this is like the best thing ever. When he is having sex with Julie and he's like, oh my God, father, like, you never told me how good this was. And as you're reading this, you're like, wow, like, okay, like Gabriel's getting a happy ending, so to speak.
Did he? I kind of wonder if he did, or did she like literally?
I feel like he did. And at the moment he did, she ripped out his heart.
Because, like, she actually needed him to?
I don't know if she needed him to, but I think, or maybe right before he was about to, she rips out
his heart. I mean, that to me seems like the best point at which to do what thing. She does, which is like, you're evil.
You know that?
Well, I'm only thinking from a succubus's point of view, especially true. One who has, you know, a specific bone to pick with him.
Right.
That if I were to pick the moment, that would be right before.
Yes.
just icing on the cake, you know?
Yeah, yeah. No pun intended. Anyway. yeah, did you, the whole reveal that Chantinelli is actually Julie and, you know, she rips out his heart and it's all because I didn't get this until I re-looked at these for this podcast. I didn't realize that Gabriel was one of the angels that killed her love, Tali in the first story arc. Did you know it was him?
That was an amazing reveal. And actually, I'm glad they did because I still felt bad for Gabriel. I really did. As much as he seems to have been an asshole and you know, preying on him at this like moment of weakness, and it did seem like a really dick move to be like, and but why him? Like, just because he was in this moment and they could get him, it still seemed like going out of their way.
Oh, it's petty.
Like he asked, you know, asking why must he do this just because I was happy? And then it's like, oh no, motherfucker, it's because you hurt her first. And so then I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can kind of see how that's justified.
Yeah. At least her side of it. But then John, the only reason is because John is like, you motherfucker, you didn't help me when I was dying. Which seems a bit petty because he did figure out. Although I guess in John's eyes, it's like, if you would help me, I wouldn't have had to have this whole thing with the first going on because it would have never came up.
You know, right.
If Gabriel had just been like, yeah, I'll help you with your cancer and not been such an asshole, then John would have been cured and the first wouldn't even know who he is.
Yeah, for an angel, that's very unkind to not help someone in need. So, I mean, even back then, he was kind of a douchey angel in the first place.
Yeah, they called him the snob for a reason, right?
Right.
yeah, so I love that story arc, that side of it. The racist story arc that's going along in tandem is a pretty hard one to stomach, especially because it's so violent and everything. But then the snob story where they rip out his heart and that now they're like, oh, we control you because we have your heart. This is also like great lore because it's like, oh, apparently you can control an angel if you rip out its heart. It's like, I don't think that's ever said anywhere, but sure, why not? Like, you just go along with it.
Apparently in the special version of that Bible he got, I think. Is what
Yeah, yeah. Yes, that's why he needed Rick the Vic so he could get the foreskin Bible.
Which, ugh.
Yeah, yeah. How many foreskins? That's what I want.
And is it the cover? Is it?
It must be just the cover.
Are you sure?
You can't write on foreskins. How do you write on foreskins?
Can't you pull it out, dry it?
I don't think so.
It's a messed up book. I gotta say.
yeah. So
maybe that was the guy's name who wrote the book.
Yeah. Right. Let's hope for us and. Unfortunately for him, his name was Foreskin. but yeah, so that leads us to our last issue, which is a one kind of like a one-off, not a one-off, but a conclusion issue that's not part of that storyline. This is the kind of big issue that sets up the next progression of John's life. We get Kit breaking up with John and Chaz breaking up with John for lack of a better term, but becoming unfriends with John. This is like such a, it feels like John, you know, cause he's not a good guy necessarily. I mean, he's fine, but like, yeah, like stuff happens and it's bad stuff and he never seems to get what's coming to him. And, at least, but from like people standpoint. So it is kind of nice in a little bit to see John get like, especially from Chaz, like he gives Chaz so much shit and he like uses him all the time for rides and all this kind of stuff. And then finally Chaz is like, you know what? Fuck you. And like punches him and puts his head in the toilet. I think that's fun.
One too many jokes about Chaz's wife. That was the breaking point.
Exactly. And then, but then also you have John's life being destroyed or like being torn apart because Kit is like, hey, we had one rule in our relationship and that was keep me out of it. And John did not keep her out of it. Unfortunately, he was busy being tied up and tortured or and not tortured, but watching Des get tortured. And was unable to make it to help Kit out when she was fighting off those goons, even though she didn't need John. But it was the first thing that's come into her life from John, like that's fallout from John's actions. So, she's like, no, I had a rule. And it did seem, I don't know if you felt like this, that there was a couple moments where if John had just answered correctly,
not been an asshole,
yeah, not been an asshole, that it could have totally salvaged this thing.
But yeah.
John's going to totally. Jump. And so,
yeah,
he's going to be snarky or he doesn't want to be vulnerable. So he says, you know,
the wrong thing,
some sarcastic thing or yeah. And then Kit's like, well, fuck you then, you know? So, it's sad. And then also, I mean, I don't want to spoil anything, but, you know, at this point, usually in a story when this happens with like a breakup or whatever, there's a whole like, will they, won't they thing.
Yeah.
But Garth doesn't even entertain that shit. Like a lesser writer would take this relationship he's built up to finally being like a happy thing. Because in issue 40, at the beginning of this Fear and Loathing story arc, or not issue 40, issue 63, when John turns 40, like it ends with him and Kit going to bed. And then Fear and Loathing part one starts with them waking up after having sex and they're so happy and their life is so great. And he tears that down within three issues. And then normally like a lesser writer would take the time to be like, oh, I'm going to tease the reader. Like, oh, are they going to get back together? Are they not? Well, we'll find out in the next run or whatever, or the next couple story arcs that John does not, He doesn't even, like, Garth Ennis doesn't even entertain that thought. Like, there's no, like, John pining after her and all this stuff. So I think it's a very unique relationship that Garth sets up here and then ruins in this issue. But what do you think about this whole, like John loses everybody issue?
Well, it seems like this was just a culmination of his own self-destruction and his own sort of, like, negative prophecy of what he assumed was going to happen. It's almost like he self-sabotages, you know, everything. I'm happy, but it can't last forever because I'm John. Therefore, he does and says the wrong things to sort of make it happen. You know, it's like one of those people who's always like, oh, I'm never going to, you know, get that promotion. But then they also don't do anything to sort of like ensure that they would.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, you know, you do the bare minimum or like you do less than nothing, or you do all the wrong things because you assume it's going to turn out bad anyway. So you never actually really try to salvage that, it or
they like lie to themselves in their head.
Yeah. Which also seems totally a John thing as well.
Yeah. Yeah. That could also be it.
It was heartbreaking because, you know, it seemed like she was really good for him. But at the same time, that also is such a trope of like, oh, the woman is there to help the guy. And she even says that. She's even like self-aware enough to be like, I'm just here to help him and lift him up. But what about me? You know?
Right. Yeah.
Because what does he really do to reciprocate besides sex? I mean, he's staying at her house.
Right.
He's not really contributing much else to the relationship besides his dick. So like,
true.
What else is he really doing for them? It's all about him and his occasional missions and his magic and her only rule of like, hey, just don't bring that shit home with you. And he breaks it anyway, even though it technically wasn't his fault, but yes, it was his fault. Cause he still initiated something that came back on him and her. So it's just one of those things of like, rather than apologize and actually work to say like, hey, you know what? I am going to try and keep this shit separate because you mean a lot to me. and I want to put the effort in. It's like, no, it's like, oh, you're still on that? Just get over it. This is who I am, bitch. And it's just like, oh, no, she's not going to take that. She doesn't need that. As much as she loves him, it's like, you know, you obviously aren't putting me first or our relationship first. So, you know, you can fuck off. I'm going home.
Yeah, the saddest thing about this is that we lose Kit for a character, at least for a while.
Yeah.
And
man, that sucks.
And yeah, because she is such a great character. I think he spent a lot of time building her up, and because he wrote this storyline in a different way than most people would take it. Yeah, like she is her own woman, and she goes and does her own thing. But I will tell you that there is an issue that comes out, I think, maybe like in 4 or 5 issues. It came out a while ago. It came out a while after this. I think maybe like 3 years after this run. Garth Ennis and Steve Dillon wrote an issue called Heartland that was just a one-shot that didn't say anything about Hellblazer or anything on it. It was just called Heartland, and it's about Kit in Ireland. And it's about like what she's doing now. So it catches people up, you know, who cared to know what's going on in Kit's life. So
that's nice.
Yeah. I'm not going to read it for the podcast, but it is there if anyone is interested in what happens to Kit, you know, later.
Boo.
It's it's just about her and her family. So
I don't care. Read it.
Look, I love Kit.
Go out and find it.
But having to do 5 different Irish accents is not something I want to try. So,
all right, fine. I will attempt to find it.
You can go find it. It's definitely available and easy to. I found it for 50¢ at a Half Price Books over here. So, I have it.
Okay, all right.
It's definitely available on eBay for fairly cheap. It's not a hard issue to find. So,
thank you for the heads up, at least.
Yeah, and it really just goes into like how Ireland was with the bombings and the police presence from England there and stuff. So it's more about that than it is necessarily about, like, it doesn't tie into John at all. So it's just about her being with her family and in Ireland. So, and what that's like, or what that was like at the time. And I think Garth even said by the time I had written this, it had all changed. Like, it wasn't this anymore. Like, something they came, like, I don't know what happened politically, but something was signed, like a treaty or some shit, and there wasn't the same kind of military presence in Ireland anymore by the time the issue came out. But when he wrote it, it was still. So, like, it was kind of interesting because he had, like, a foreword, I think, in that in the beginning of that issue about it. But, definitely check that out. It's called Heartland, and it's just a one-shot issue. So,
That's by so cool.
Steve Dillon. Yeah.
Oh, well, you know, I'm glad that, I mean, even if he was just writing it to write about the politics of that time and that moment and happened to weave it around Kit because he's like, oh, she's there. I forgot. And, you know, so weaving her into the story, if what he really wanted to write about was the sort of like political atmosphere at that time in that place, it's still nice of him to think of a character that, I mean, I like and hopefully other people really liked. And at least giving us a little bit of closure in that sense. So that's cool.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's nice. It was kind of like he wanted to tell the story about Ireland because he's Irish. And then also, I'm pretty sure he's Irish. Either that or he had a penchant for talking about it because he did bring it up a lot in this run as well of Hellblazer. But it definitely, it was nice to like see what's going on with Kit a couple years later kind of thing. So, so that's where we're stopping today. Issue 67, and John's life takes a terrible turn after he loses all his friends and his girlfriend. So we'll have to catch up with that in the next issue. I wanted to see, did you have any questions for me or want to talk about anything else I didn't talk about?
Did you have a particular cover that you liked this time?
There are 2 covers I like in this one. I love the, what is it, issue 60, which is the second issue of Guys and Dolls, which is the demon and the succubus kind of like embracing in the sky, and they're like intertwined.
That one's my favorite too. I loved that one.
That's a great, great cover. And I'll say, you know, Glenn Fabry did all these covers for a while in Hellblazer. He is killing it. This arc specifically has some really fucking amazing looking artwork. Just like it's not photorealistic, but I don't know. He gives so much like.
It looks like one of those like, what's that guy's name? That guy who draws those really awesome like warrior women and like Frank Frazetta. And yeah, that's what it reminded me of. That sort of like really epic fantasy sort of like it like intense look of a con where you know it's not real, but it has that realism to it that just makes it look like you could almost reach out and touch it and it would be real.
Cause he does like such muscle definition and veins.
Yeah.
And stuff.
It was so cool.
It's really good. I love that. And then, there's another cover that I was also love, and it's issue 65, which is the second, cover for Fear and Loathing. And it's just Kit standing on the edge of, or on the, like,
that's my second favorite too.
Yeah. It's great. I love it. It's just, the way she's staring so like longingly, it's perfect. Like, it captures exactly what he wants to go for.
I will say that the contrast between what she looks like in that cover and the art of her on the inside from the panels that you share, didn't realize it was the same person. So that's my only thing, is that she's drawn a little more square jawed in the comics.
Yeah, but that's just Steve Dillon.
So that's like the only thing where I'm like, it's the contrast of it made me think, like, who's this lady on the cover?
Yeah.
And then, you know, when you, oh, by the way, it's Kit on it. It's like, that's Kit? Really? So that was my only thing, is like, she looks gorgeous and maybe a little less so in the actual body of the comic. So
yeah. Well, Steve Dillon's going to Steve Dillon. He's got a way to draw faces and they look like they do.
Yeah, a bit.
And so, I mean, like, everybody's got a very similar face style, at least. Like, I can't quite put my finger on it. They do look different, but they also look the same. And that is something I had to get used to. And it's not just for Hellblazer. He does a bunch of Punisher with Garth Ennis later, and the Punisher looks a lot like John. And, like, you know, who looks a lot like these people. Yeah, like, he has a face and he sticks with it, you know? So,
well, I guess that's the curse of having to draw so many people, is that some of them end up kind of looking the same.
Yeah, I think he just had a style that's what he did. You know, he's like, this is how I build faces, and that's that. Like, if you don't like it, then fuck off. But it's definitely grown on me over the years, because when I originally read this run, I was like, huh, all right, like, because it's so different than like who was it, Simpson, who did like the first arc, the Dangerous Habits arc, of this run. So like,
I did like that art style.
I do too. I like that art style better, I think, but just for the consistency, once I got used to his artwork, it is nice to have the same guy through pretty much the rest of the entire series, or the entire run of Garth Ennis on this. Because it stays the same. Like, it stays, and he's really good at others. Like, everything else is good, like the detail and all that stuff. He's great at everything. Just the faces have Steve Dillon quality to them, which is funny. I always wonder, like, sometimes artists will use themselves as model references because they don't have anybody to, like, if they're like, I need a certain way to look, and they can't, and this is before Google and all that shit. So they would, like, stand in front of a mirror and hold a gun or whatever they needed the pose to be, and then they take a picture. Well, if you do that, then sometimes your face can become the face of the protagonist or whatever a bit. And maybe that's what it is. I don't know. I don't know. But
that would be weird.
Yeah. I do notice it later on, like in the issues that I'm at in the Patreon stuff with Sean Phillips. All of a sudden, John gets kind of like a little, like an upward turned nose. And then I look at pictures of Sean Phillips. I'm like, he looks a lot like John. Like, he's got the same fucking nose. So, like, he uses him for reference, obviously. And I think a lot of artists do that. So maybe, I've never seen a picture of Steve Dillon. Maybe he has a very square face. I don't know. But yeah, so those are my two favorite covers. Anything else?
No, I think we covered pretty much everything I was thinking of. I'm just really happy that we were able to go through these stories. And I was happy to see more about Ellie and her history. I loved knowing more about Gabriel as well, and like how he ended up is just so it's sad, but also you kind of feel like he deserved it, you know?
Yeah, for sure. He was such a dick, so.
Yeah, he really was, and he did some horrible things. So I'm actually rooting for Ellie in this one. In this one instance, I'm rooting for her.
She's a character that I really like, and I'm glad they don't get rid of her after Garth Ennis. She's one of the ones that continues, so that's kind of nice.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so I think she appears in the Paul Jenkins run a couple times. So.
Oh, awesome. I can't wait.
Yeah. So, well, with that, I'm looking at the issues coming up. I think we'll go to issue 75, which will be a little bit of a shorter chunk. So we'll cover 68 to 75 in the next one.
Oh, fun. Actually, I can't wait.
We might do, I guess we could. Well, we could go to 77.
Oh, nice.
We'll go to 77, yeah.
Nice long stretch. Sounds good.
Yeah. So it'll be good. And as always, if you guys like this and you want to catch up on Patreon, because I'm about 40 issues ahead of where we're at. If you're all caught up on this and you're like, oh, I can't wait till next time you guys talk about it. Or the weekly podcast I put out, and you want to catch up on the 40 issues that I'm way ahead, then you can go to patreon.com/planestrainsandcomicbooks, all one word, and sign up for the Hellblazer tier, where you will get all those issues and all the back issues as well, or the back episodes as well. I think as of this week, we're at issue 114. So that's a good chunk ahead that you could catch up on if you need to get more John in your life. So with that, I think we'll see you guys on the next one.
See you later.
Bye.